provided them the means to influence policy, at least in theory. Aid programs inevitably involve degrees of wastage and misallocation. Hoffman and Bissell took this seriously and devised market-oriented mechanisms and controls to keep them to a minimum. The first 6 months were devoted largely to relief efforts, but thereafter the focus shifted to recovery and integration. Cannon had feared that operational control of the Marshall Fund outside the State Department would lead to confusion, contradiction, and ineffectiveness. Yet in the end, according to the ECA's Robert Oceans, the major difficulties which were expected never did occur. The most innovative of the Marshall Plan mechanisms, designed by Bissell, was the use of counterpart funds. Hoffman, who began operating them in September 1948, called them the single greatest tool we have for recovery. When the press, which was generally laudatory of the Marshall Plan, failed to mention counterpart funds often enough for Hoffman, he scolded them. "You mustn't get the idea that you are too perfect," he told the American Society of Newspaper Editors. "You have not explained how counterpart funds are used." Under the arrangement, a French farmer needing an American harvester would buy it from the French government in francs. The ECA would then pay the American exporter in dollars, while the francs were deposited at the French Central Bank to fund a recovery program devised in cooperation with the ECA. This structure comprised projects such as mine mechanization, railway electrification, and dam construction, but extended to fiscal and monetary stabilization. The counterpart funds regime served multiple purposes. The farmer would not be getting a gift, but would be spending his own money on the equipment he needed most. As he would pay in francs rather than dollars, there would be no negative effect on the French balance of payments. The French government then had the means to finance recovery spending without resorting to inflationary policies, as it had been for so long. The ECA approved and monitored all expenditures. But Harriman emphasized that 95% of the program is European. He neglected to highlight that recipient governments were required to match each dollar of Marshall aid with an equivalent amount in domestic currency to be used for jointly approved purposes. Each dollar of Marshall aid, therefore, gave the United States influence over the allocation of $2 worth of resources to recovery efforts. Yet the theory behind counterpart funds was always weak. If a recipient government wanted to spend the local currency it generated by the sale of goods donated from the United States, it could always offset a U.S. blockage of the funds through standard monetary policy operations called sterilization. Effectively, the central bank could print the equivalent new currency at home and spend it with no inflationary effect. Given that American economists were aware of this at the time, the ECA had to have been as well. Not surprisingly, it used the mechanism sparingly. In Britain, the Attlee Labour government directed 97% of counterpart funds to retiring government debt, thereby depriving the ECA of levers it might, even in principle, have applied to change economic priorities in London. The only areas in which British policy was clearly steered from Washington were trade liberalization, which had been a condition of going back to wartime lend-lease aid, and European Payments Union membership, both of which London initially resisted. The aid itself, however, amounting to 1.9% of GDP from 1948 to 1951, served to prop up a socialist program of nationalization and industrial controls with which the Truman administration, not to mention Republican legislators, strongly disagreed. Economists have invoked this factor to help explain why the aid's growth impact appears to have been much poorer in Britain than elsewhere. Yet in understanding the Marshall Plan, wider American political aims must not be ignored, and indeed cannot be separated from economic ones. The best way to serve U.S. interests in our relations with the USSR, argued State Department official R.G. Hooker in September 1946, is to support the non-communist left. This dictum was more or less the department's policy toward Britain throughout the Marshall years. On the ideological level, The election of a socialist labor government in Britain has strengthened that country's domestic position vis-à-vis Soviet propaganda, reasoned a June 1948 policy statement. A government of this type is not so vulnerable with its own people as a conservative regime might be to charges of reactionary prejudice against the Soviets, and a socialist flavor to its policies is a good antidote to communist appeal abroad. The implication was that interference in British domestic economic policy might undermine American political aims, which in turn could stymie economic recovery. In France and Italy, U.S. influence over policy was even more limited by the priority of keeping the communists from power. The French and Italian governments, in return for excluding the communists, had enormous leeway to pursue their own agendas within broad confines renegotiated continuously with the United States. The contrast between the operation of the Marshall Plan in the two countries illustrates how powerful was the overarching objective of containing the communists. After the war, France and Italy had a similar political complexion. Both saw the formation of tripartite coalitions of Christian Democrats on the center-right, socialists on the center-left, and communists on the far-left. Both countries suffered from high deficits, inflationary pressure, and scarce goods, and focused political energies on keeping peace with communist-led labor movements. Under pressure from Washington in the spring of 1947, however, both governments expelled the communists. At this point, their policy paths diverged. In France, where the left commanded a larger share of the vote, the socialists became the leading party in the coalition. In Italy, the Christian Democrats assembled a cabinet with no representation from the left. In both cases, the door was left open for future communist participation, but Stalin slammed it shut. With the creation of the Cominform in September, Moscow ordered the French and Italian communists to abandon efforts at cooperation with parties supporting the Marshall Plan. In France, the autumn rise of the Gaullist RPF party, committed to centralization of power and opposed to American dollar diplomacy, bound the socialists and Christian Democrats together in a difficult coalition, in opposition to both the communists and the right. The socialists dominated, however, and pushed forward with their state-led investment plan. Fiscal and monetary stabilization would take a back seat. Whereas Christian Democrat Georges Bidault remained France's friendly face to the State Department, he was attacked at home, from the left and the right, for being in bed with the Anglo-Saxons. In Italy, the economic agenda of the controlling center-right parties was dominated by the free market liberals, led by Deputy Prime Minister, Budget Minister, Bank of Italy Governor, and later President, Luigi Einaudi. Einaudi scoffed at the Keynesian American idea that the country's underemployment problems were a symptom of insufficient demand that might be revived with government investment. Part of the difference between the two national approaches is history. Fears of revived fascist corporatism, for example, influenced policy in Italy. Another part of the difference relates to a more developed bureaucratic infrastructure for statistics and planning in France. Even if the Italians had had a Monnet plan, they would have lacked the capacity to implement one. The result was that the Americans were typically at odds with the French over their neglect of fiscal and monetary stabilization, and with the Italians over excessive zeal in reducing inflation and insufficient commitment to investment planning. The Marshall Planners set up operations in Europe in the summer of 1948, choosing Paris as their base. This was a time of rapidly rising tensions with Moscow, adding to the premium Washington placed on political stability in France. Trade unions from dockers to postal workers were permeated with communist moles tasked with disrupting operations and communications related to transatlantic diplomatic and military cooperation. French communists tarred the country's government as a second Vichy, operating under the direction of imperialists in Washington. Against this backdrop, Ambassador Caffery was concerned not merely with Schuman's ability to roll back the communist threat, but to survive a preemptive anti-communist coup led by de Gaulle's intelligence service, which continued on after he left power in January 1946. The general had blasted the provisions of the London Accord on Germany as a prelude to the formation of a Reich at Frankfurt. Approving Schuman's program for fiscal and monetary stabilization, Washington released 25 billion francs, $108 million of interim-aid counterpart funds in April 1948, mostly for Manet Plan projects. Undermined in part by Bideau's signature on the London Accord, however, Schuman's government was buffeted by strikes and threats of insurrection. It collapsed on July 19th. Fearful of what might replace it, Washington blocked the release of further funds pending the establishment of a new coalition that could show actual progress on stabilization. Toughness evaporated, however, in September when Henri Queux, the soft-spoken, intelligent but temporizing country doctor, emerged as prime minister. Paris ECA mission chief David Bruce insisted that withholding funds, even if justified on narrow economic grounds, might boomerang against ERP ultimate goals. He successfully pleaded for their quick release. The unpleasant fact, Hickerson wrote in October, is that there is no apparent alternative to our continuing for the present our policy of assisting the French government, even though it seems to be losing ground insofar as ECA objectives are concerned. Conditionality was showing its limits. Washington prized a stable, non-communist, non-Gaullist French government more than it did its own immediate economic objectives. In January 1949, Paris-based playwright Samuel Beckett finished the script of his now famous Waiting for Godot. Throughout that year, ECA Paris would, too, wait impatiently for the man who would never come, the French leader who would bring stabilization. Concerned that Stalin was fomenting communist violence to trigger a Gaullist coup, or worse, it reluctantly continued releasing aid until Queux's cabinet fell in October. Bideau's new government returned to the wrangling, however, extracting its re-release. He succeeded not through concessions, but by subtly convincing the ECA that, without the funds, it would resort to even more inflationary financing to sustain investment. Yet French macroeconomic indicators were improving. The budget deficit fell from 9.7% of gross national product in 1948 to 7.3% in 1949. Inflation fell from 58.6% to 12.7%. The current account deficit from 5.7% of GNP to 1.8%. And whereas the carrot of counterpart funds had not worked as the ECA had hoped, the funds had allowed a succession of moderate governments in France to continue cooperation with the United States on a politically sensitive program of Western economic and security integration. By 1950, the ECA had shifted its focus from badgering Bideau to stabilize the economy to badgering him to publicize the Marshall Plan's success. In line with this lurch, strategy also shifted from threatening to withhold funds to telling Bideau how to use them. Among the more comical propaganda efforts proposed was creating a Marshall Plan Tour de France cycling team and a Tour de France board game with players advancing over Marshall-funded roads and bridges. These efforts were dismissed by the French cabinet, which argued that they would be mocked by the communists and do more harm than good if the bike team lost. ECA efforts to shunt funds from the government's beloved investment initiatives and toward low-cost housing, hospital, and school building, which might give Marshall funding more visible impact, were either refused or only accommodated grudgingly. The government had its own plans for stimulating house construction with private financing and resented American interference. In May 1950, the ECA conceded defeat. None of the technicians of the mission are to insist on having any project undertaken in his way, nor is he permitted to employ the threat of withholding counterpart funds as a bargaining device, the new directive said. Attempting to force our views embroils us in French politics and fails to achieve American aims. The surprise attack by communist forces in North Korea on the South in June 1950 triggered fears in Paris that Moscow might initiate similar action in Europe, across the line dividing the Germanies. As French defense expenditures began climbing, they would soar 48% in 1951, Washington became concerned inflation would accelerate. The ECA looked again at withholding counterpart funds until Paris came into line on stabilization. In early 1951, however, the ECA counterpart National Advisory Council concluded that such conditionality was ineffective, and indeed counterproductive. If the French Treasury is forced to find other means of financing its expenditures, it would undoubtedly resort to additional borrowing from the Bank of France. In short, Washington failed to buy French compliance with its stabilization demands, in spite of France having secured the second largest share of Marshall aid. It failed not because it had no leverage, but because financial stabilization was not an American priority. Political aims took precedence, in particular, securing French governments committed to resisting communism. Créa stressed to Marshall that he had crushed communist-led strikes intended to sabotage the ERP. He had cracked down on communist union racketeering, and he had kept wage increases from running ahead of price rises, even if the latter were higher than Washington wanted. Marshall must not, Créa implored, lose sight of the big picture. In this battle between East and West, he said, France is yet one more time the front-line sentry of civilization. It was not just the threat of losing Marshall aid that stiffened Créa's resistance to the Communist Party and its union arm. He knew that any return to tripartism, with the communists back in government, would mean an end to French influence over the reconstitution of post-war Germany. The United States knew there was no better, more stabilization-friendly French government waiting to emerge. Gaullism or communism were far more clear and present threats to French recovery than elevated deficits and inflation. In the end, then, the Marshall Plan did not institute the sort of robust policy conditionality that Clayton had envisioned in 1947. But against the much worse Cold War backdrop that prevailed after the Berlin blockade, it did enough to satisfy the changed priorities in both Washington and Paris. In Italy, the ECA was at war with itself. Rome mission head James Zellerbach, a former paper manufacturing executive from San Francisco, was passionate about redirecting Marshall funds from importing relief supplies such as wheat and coal to importing machinery and equipment to build up Italy's productive system. His policy priorities were lower taxes and interest rates. The ECA and its counterpart, National Advisory Council in Washington, however, were focused, as they had been in France, on stabilization, particularly controlling inflation. ECA Washington was prepared to delay counterpart funds expenditures at the first sign of its rise, and undertook a campaign of education to change priorities at the Rome mission. De Gasperi's government, of its own accord, and before Marshall had even thought of making a speech at Harvard, was also focused on stabilization. Unlike the French, the Italians wanted to spend their counterpart funds slowly, to control inflation. They required no arm twisting from Washington. The result was much more rapid progress in Italy. From 62.1% in 1947, 49.2% in France, inflation fell to 5.9% in 1948, while rising 58.6% in France. It was down by 1.2% by 1949, against 12.7% in France. Also, unlike the French, and to ECA Rome's constant consternation, the Italians had no interest in investment planning. They wanted to direct the funds to political priorities, such as alleviating unemployment through public works and emigration. Throughout the Marshall years, Italian gross investment, net of inventories, as a proportion of GDP, remained below pre-war levels, while it rose well above them in France. In autumn 1948, De Gasperi embraced ECA Washington, proclaiming his commitment to stabilization. Zellerbach, he understood, could be ignored. He agreed, therefore, only to add some undefined industrial recovery scheme to his priority public works program. Treasury Minister Giuseppe Pella remained determined to rely on private investment, which, she argued, would be stimulated by freeing up funds through cuts in the budget deficit. The pro-investment faction within the ECA disagreed. More government investment was needed to step in for deficient business confidence. They pleaded for something parallel to France's Monnet plan, a national investment budget that was not merely the sum of projects which the various agencies had already devised, but the product of a coherent modernization strategy. Year after year, ECA stabilizers were at odds with ECA investment enthusiasts. All they could agree on was that De Gasperi and Pella were solidly pro-American and anti-communist, and therefore merited Washington support. In Italy, meanwhile, intense factional disagreement on policy within the Christian Democratic Party made it impossible for De Gasperi to win approval for the sort of comprehensive investment program Washington wanted. Parliament failed to approve some ECA-approved projects and approved others the ECA would not approve. The result was slow spending of counterpart funds and increasing American frustration at the disappointing pace of Italian recovery. The ECA took a new tack in late 1949, threatening to withhold funds for Italian imports unless they included more machinery for industrial modernization. Pella countered that the funds were better spent importing commodities, revenue from the sale of which could be used to relieve unemployment in the South and other depressed regions. The government made only modest, narrow concessions to boost machine tool imports. It never produced an investment program worthy of the name. In the fall of 1950, new Rome mission chief Leon Dayton created a diplomatic storm by blasting Italian business for profiteering at the expense of underpaid workers. With war in Korea raging, Washington also began pushing Italy in a new direction. Overcautious monetary policies, Secretary of State Acheson wrote to the Rome embassy in December, were holding back both the investment program implementation and an effective defense production program essential to Italian and Western armament. He criticized Pella for fixing on lira stabilization at the expense of the new American priority of rearmament. Though European financial stabilization had been a fundamental economic objective of the Marshall Plan, ECA official Harlan Cleveland concluded that, in the case of Italy, stressing it had been a strategic mistake. Putting equal emphasis on two sides of the scale, stabilization and investment, is not in practice an impartial attitude when the scale is already tipped by the bias of Italian financial policy in one direction. Given that De Gasperi's government had always been determined to achieve stabilization, he concluded that Washington could only have achieved both objectives by neglecting the first and pushing twice as hard on the second. Broadly, it cannot be said that the Marshall Plan succeeded in France and Italy by encouraging a policy agenda different from that preferred by their governments. Washington adapted its desires and expectations to a far greater extent than did Paris or Rome. Without Marshall aid, however, it is far less likely that those governments would have had the necessary popular support, let alone the resources, to pursue those policies. More likely, they would have had different compositions, and therefore different agendas. Communists would likely have remained a part of the French and Italian governing coalitions in 1947, although a Gaullist backlash could well have upended communist participation in France. The Marshall Plan succeeded in keeping the communists and Gaullists out of government, but that success came at a price. Despite the theatrics of negotiation with the ECA, the French and Italian governments did largely as they pleased, at least domestically. The challenge for France was that it could not resist American policy in Germany. After the launch of the Marshall Plan, France found it increasingly difficult to use its occupation zone as a bargaining chip for economic and security concessions. France not only wanted Marshall aid, but needed it once the United States began shutting off its avenues to extracting reparations, territory, and underpriced commodities from Germany. American power in Germany ultimately obliged Paris to accommodate itself to Washington's Western integration agenda. It is difficult to overstate the singular importance of Germany in the Cold War conflict. In many ways, the conflict was about Germany. Kennan understood, that West European recovery was essential to the protection of U.S. economic and security interests, and that such recovery was itself dependent on a revival of German industry, most of which was fortuitously based in the Western occupation zones. Keeping it beyond Russian control was, therefore, itself essential. The creation of a strong, independent West Germany, integrated into a robust West European economic and North Atlantic security architecture, represented a fundamental departure in policy from the late FDR years, one without which it is difficult now to imagine a peaceful end to the Cold War on American terms. As Marshall prepared to fly to Moscow in March 1947, Eleanor Roosevelt was organizing a national conference on the problem of Germany in New York City, featuring dozens of prominent backers from Henry Morgenthau to Albert Einstein, to protest what was believed to be Marshall's pro-German agenda. The conference urged the Secretary of State not to abandon Yalta and Potsdam for the sake of creating a German buffer state, one that would, in the words of publishing titan William Ziff, Sr., inevitably dominate through sheer force of economic power. Instead, it called for U.S. endorsement of French claims to the Saar Basin and reparations paid in factories and coal to build up non-German European industry. General Clay took no issue with reparations in principle. Indeed, he dismantled hundreds of German factories deemed surplus because they were not immediately usable, given shortages of fuel, power, and commodities inputs. Across the three Western zones combined, the Allies removed equipment from 706 plants. Germans, for their part, preferred reparations from current production to dismantling. Clay got so angered with German attacks over his actions that in November 1948, he threatened to dismantle 20 plants as punishment for each such future attack. Clay's stance on limiting reparations was based on what a self-sustaining Germany could bear, and not aimed at stymieing Soviet demands. An admirer of FDR's diplomatic genius in managing U.S.-Soviet relations, who was on warm personal terms with both Zhukov and Solokovsky, he had been committed to cooperation with the Soviets in Germany, believing it would create a template for the two countries to work together worldwide. His objection to Morgenthau was not that it was not a program for German peace. Rather, to him, it meant abandoning Germany to chaos. Forced upon a country in which one in three babies was dying within a year, and where coal and other export goods were needed to pay for vital food imports, it meant a deepening humanitarian crisis, threats to basic law and order, and huge additional financial and security burdens on the United States. By 1948, Germany had emerged from pariah status in the United States to become the fulcrum of the Marshall Plan. During the war, the country expanded its industrial capacity dramatically, an average of 3.36 billion Reichsmarks worth per year, $1.34 billion or $19.9 billion in today's money, from 1940 to 1945. After the war, the Western Allies were surprised to find that, in spite of the enormous damage done to the German housing stock, only about 18% of industrial capacity had been destroyed by bombing. Thus, after targeted repairs to bottleneck suppliers and transport infrastructure, Germany emerged from the conflict with considerably greater industrial capacity than that with which it had begun. It therefore had the imminent potential to provide its neighbors with much-needed capital goods and industrial commodities, items that the United States could only provide, where it could provide them at all, at greater cost to itself and a dollar-starved Europe. The fact, therefore, that the Truman administration had the means to set policy largely as it wished in Western Germany gave it the power to pursue economic statecraft on a grand scale. On the ground in Germany, one of the earliest significant American efforts to boost output was the reconstruction of the rail and transport system in 1947, well before Marshall aid was appropriated. Action of this sort, not to mention the historic airlift in Berlin the following year, disproved Nazi propaganda that defeat would mean the destruction of German industry and mass starvation. It thereby eased acceptance among West Germans of the subsequent division of their country. The Truman administration was determined that Germany's recovery and Western Europe's would not be held back by the financial legacy of war. American grants in aid to West Germany, which reached a high of 4% of GNP in 1950, do not even begin to measure the benefits to the country from Marshall's program. Aid figures ignore the vast and consequential write-off of the country's debt. Germany's total official public debt after the war, 86% of which was domestic, amounted to nearly four times the country's 1938 GDP. The United States abolished it through the 1948 currency reform that introduced the Deutschmark. Banks holding the debt received compensating assets to prevent their collapse. As regards external debt, the 1953 London Agreement reduced the principal and interest on obligations incurred through 1933, when the country defaulted, and postponed settlement of obligations subsequently created until sometime after a future German unification, when a reparations conference could be held. During the war, Germany also accumulated large external debts through a European payments clearing system established by the Reichsbank. This mechanism, through which the Nazi regime financed virtually all of its trade deficits with Europe, overvalued the Reichsmark as a means of expropriating its neighbors. When calculated at realistic exchange rates, Germany's unsettled external payments obligations amounted to nearly 90% of its 1938 GDP by the war's end. The Truman administration was determined not to repeat the mistakes of the 1924 Dawes Plan, through which the United States effectively financed Germany's external obligations. It cleverly prevented this fate by classifying its aid to Germany as credits rather than grants, and then requiring other Marshall Aid recipients to forego claims on Germany until the country repaid those credits. Until the United States chose to exercise claims against Germany, which it had no intention of doing, no one else would be able to. The value of our claim, Lovett told Marshall in December 1947, was in treaty negotiations. It was the basis for keeping other claims down. Washington forced Germany's neighbors to choose between Marshall aid and trying to collect on German debts. They chose the sure thing, U.S. aid. The United States secured, in return for this aid, only modest influence over French and Italian economic policy. Yet it was able virtually to dictate policy in Germany. As Clay put it simply, there was no German government. We were it, absolute and sovereign. The United States was therefore far more assertive in imposing its agenda there than elsewhere in Europe. It is notable that Clay dismissed the first German bizonal economic director, the ever-voluble Johannes Semmler, for the modest crime of publicly condemning American food aid as Hühnerfutter, or chicken feed. Clay was a dictator. He was a benign one by any reasonable standard, but a dictator nonetheless. One who was determined to leave his post with Germany committed to capitalism. It was to his mind not just Soviet communism that had to be kept out of Germany, but British labor-style democratic socialism. In his visit to Washington in October 1947, a frustrated SPD leader, Kurt Schumacher, demanded to know how America could profess a commitment to German self-determination while obstructing his party's efforts to advance socialization, state ownership, and control of industry. The Truman administration would never find comfort with this question. In April 1948, the State Department acknowledged internally that when it came to the issue of socialization, it had, in spite of our handsome statements of policy regarding German self-determination, in practice not arrived at any concrete action. On the ground in Germany, Clay did his own version of St. Augustine. Lord, make me chaste, but not yet. While pledging his commitment to German home rule, he would only permit it after private enterprise and a market economy seemed assured. We do believe that free enterprise has developed a high standard of living in America, Clay told German trade unionists in September 1947. However, we believe in democracy more than we do free enterprise. We have no desire to impose any particular economic structure upon the German people. Much has been said about the United States attempting to stop socialization in Germany when it is desired by the German people. That is not our position. Although we do hope that you will see some of the virtues that result from free enterprise before you make your decisions. In practice, Clay used pretexts to block socialization. In 1947, he suspended a Hessian referendum vote in favor of socialization and co-determination, union representation on corporate boards, and blocked all subsequent attempts to implement it. "They were foreign to my way of thinking and to the American way of thinking," Clay commented years later. "I was going to try my best to prove that in encouraging free enterprise, we were encouraging a more rapid recovery for Germany." But he denied imposing his ideological views. "I thought it was the job of military government to maintain free enterprise in Germany until the Germans were capable of making that choice for themselves," he said, referring to a future united Germany, or at least the western part of it. This insistence that only the totality of the German people could decide on socialization allowed him to champion self-determination while blocking Länder legislation he didn't like. Whereas Washington did not try to use its control of Marshall funds to stop socialization in Britain, it did use its funding of food and other British occupation costs to stop socialization in the British zone of Germany. Attlee's Labour government, mainly for ideological reasons, wanted public ownership of coal and heavy industry in the Ruhr. For its part, the Ramadier and Schumann government, for far more practical reasons, wanted to shift the locus of such industry to France. Clay was frequently more critical of them than the Soviets. As occupiers, he said, the French lived in pomp and luxury and took the maximum out of Germany that could be taken. Both the British and French programs in Germany, Clay was convinced, would have set back German industrial recovery. In April 1947, Clay demanded assurance from our government that its desire to make economic fusion between the American and British zones work does not make it willing to accept a highly centralized economic control which will be utilized in the hands of the SPD with the support of the British military government to extend socialist influence. Marshall himself insisted that the United States would not sit by while the British tried out any ideas which they had of experimenting with socialization of mines. USAID provided the necessary sweeteners for the two allies to abandon their visions. As Kennan put it in July 1947, the United States offered the French and British the choice between a rise in German production or no European recovery financed by the U.S. Or as General Robertson put it for his country, "He who pays the piper calls the tune." In the spring of 1948, Will Clayton returned from Europe with vivid accounts of urban food shortages, which were particularly acute in Germany. The Nazi government had suppressed inflation with price controls, which led industrial output to stagnate and farmers to withhold produce. Firms and individuals resorted to using cigarettes for payment. The Soviets cared about securing German reparations from current production, but little about how the Western zones were supposed to produce them without food or economic incentives. Clay planned the 1948 currency reform that restored such incentives in secret. He had not even discussed the plans with Bizonal Economics Director Ludwig Erhard, who threatened to resign when he discovered them. Erhard subsequently changed his mind and announced them on radio as his own. That Clay, who had once been the administration's highest-level advocate of four-power cooperation in Germany, pursued currency reform unilaterally in spite of bitter Soviet protests, shows that he saw German revival as being far more important to American national interests. The Marshall Plan aimed at a substitution of German for American capital goods supply in Western Europe. It succeeded. It did so on the basis of economic and monetary reforms that the Soviets had not allowed, and would never have allowed, under the four-party control regime. "Time is on our side," Clay argued of his approach in October 1947, ignoring both Germans and Russians who disagreed with him. He was vindicated by the election of Adenauer as West Germany's first chancellor in September 1949. The new leader claimed a popular mandate against the planned economy. With the United States blocking collection on its massive accumulated debt, the new Federal Republic of Germany faced none of the temptations of post-World War I German governments. Popular pressure to adopt inflationary monetary policy, radically redistributive fiscal policy, or anti-Western foreign policy was negligible. Washington's treatment of Germany's debt was thus at the heart of the country's subsequent emergence as a model of macroeconomic orthodoxy and geopolitical conservatism. The mechanisms imposed by the Truman administration for eliminating German debt were not incidental to the Marshall Plan. They were integral to it. They were intended to minimize German and overall European reliance on American transfer payments by easing the implementation of industrial policies, monetary reforms, and trade regimes that would encourage the most rapid possible revival of European production. This revival was, in turn, intended to buttress democratic government in Europe, keeping communist and other authoritarian political forces at bay, a critical element of the emerging Soviet containment policy. "Our basic policy is to push freedom as far east as possible," Acheson told reporters off the record in May 1949. "If a united Germany contributes to that aim, fine. If not, to hell with it." In Clay's words, the State Department was only interested in Germany's relations with other countries, not in Germany itself. Once the United States had unilaterally blocked Germany's debt and reparations, it still had to deal with the problem that its neighbors would not trade with it other than through barter. No country was willing to run a trade surplus with Germany, as its exporters would take bottom priority in the long list of creditors. They would likely never be repaid. The State Department addressed this problem by mothballing the international monetary system FDR's Treasury had instituted in 1944 at Bretton Woods, and, for the Marshall countries, substituting the European Payments Union, which operated from 1950 to 1958. The system was multilateral, so participants did not care with whom they traded. Exporting to Germany no longer carried any special credit risks. At the end of each month, countries offsetting claims against each other were canceled out, and remaining surplus or deficit balances consolidated. That is, no country had any claim on any other, only against the Union as a whole. As long as countries' balances, positive or negative, remained within certain quotas, no settlements actually occurred. Once various thresholds were exceeded, however, countries settled in dollars or gold according to formula. To make the system attractive to both debtors and creditors, the United States subsidized it with $350 million of working capital, $3.5 billion in today's money, through the Marshall Plan. The capital was used to finance debtor deficits by paying out to creditors the difference between the funds the debtors put in and the greater amounts they actually owed. As regards Germany, the EPU, as a closed system, eliminated the country's difficulties importing from its neighbors by making its past debts irrelevant to the conduct of trade. It allowed Germany to re-engage with the world commercially, in Clay's words, unhampered by the curse of past political mistakes. Since the primary purpose of the system was to encourage intra-European trade, participants were required to end discrimination against imports from all other participants and to cut trade barriers by 50% in December 1949, rising in stages to 90% by January 1955. Actual settlement in gold or dollars under the EPU was less than a quarter of what it would have been outside it, which also provided a major stimulus to trade. As a result, trade within Europe expanded robustly under the EPU, from $10 billion in 1950, $100 billion today, to $23 billion in 1959, $191 billion today. Intra-European trade grew far more than trade with North America, and far more than could be explained by the much smaller rise in European output. Although West Germany would complain that the system was too debtor-friendly, allowing France and others to avoid settlement in dollars or gold, the alternative would clearly have been much less supportive of the new country's export-led revival. Creating a regional payments union would seem an archaic way of dealing with trade deficits and a dollar shortage. Today, countries would simply devalue their currencies or allow them to depreciate in foreign exchange markets. This would tend to make their goods more competitive internationally and reduce the deficits. Indeed, in August 1949, Britain, virtually dollarless and at odds with Washington over plans for protectionist retreat into the sterling area, reluctantly devalued sterling by 30% after its treasury warned of another installment of dollar crisis, even with the ERP. Germany and other nations quickly followed, 23 within a week, with the intended effect. Dollar deficits dissipated and recovery picked up steam. British reserves tripled within 2 years. In the context of the early post-war period, however, a time in which most currencies were inconvertible and trade barriers were high, global multilateral monetary and trade liberalization of the sort envisioned at Bretton Woods was utopian. Within Marshall Aid countries, establishing a stable government in which trust and cooperation could take hold among government, business, and workers was vital to the recreation of a market economy. Across Marshall countries, U.S. security guarantees and financial support were indispensable to allowing those economies to integrate without endangering unmanageable domestic and foreign conflict. Much as the State Department had anticipated, American underwriting of the EPU redirected West European imports from the United States to Germany. Western Europe's large dollar deficits between 1945 and 1948 were a reflection of Germany's disappearance as its main capital goods supplier. Massive reconstruction needs had, therefore, to be filled by the United States. It was an important ambition of the Marshall Plan to eliminate Germany's need for American aid and its neighbors' need for dollar imports, simultaneously by restoring Germany to its traditional export role. In recreating a European division of labor, with Germany as an importer of raw materials and exporter of capital goods, the Marshall Plan succeeded in cutting the transatlantic umbilical cord through which Western Europe was sucking in unaffordable dollar imports of coal and other industrial supplies. As Europe's dollar balance strengthened under the EPU, doubling between 1950 and 1956, its incentive to discriminate against dollar imports also declined. The higher dollar balance thereby enabled the Marshall countries to begin restoring currency convertibility after the EPU wound down in 1958. The EPU also succeeded in integrating Germany into Western Europe even more deeply than the United States had aimed, possibly at a permanent cost to its own export sectors. Bissell and other Marshall planners saw European integration as only a stepping stone toward the earlier Bretton Woods vision of a globally integrated world. That is, they believed that sometime soon after the plan was wound down, Europe would shed its protectionist trade and currency cocoon and quickly expand trade with the rest of the world. Within Germany, global integration had been Economics Minister Ludwig Erhard's aim: to return to the world market. In fact, Germany's intra-Western European trade increased more rapidly after 1955 than did its trade with the rest of the world, as did that of all West European countries. Intra-European integration suited Adenauer, whose priority, in contrast to Erhard, was rapprochement with France and its other immediate neighbors. The Chancellor was convinced that German integration with Western Europe would contribute to the ending of Allied controls over its economy, eventually freeing it to leverage its economic power in the area of foreign affairs. 2 decades after the launch of the Marshall Plan, Kennan concluded that his objections to the creation of the Federal Republic of Germany had been based on some grievous miscalculations. He had overestimated German hatred toward occupation, division, and Americanization, and underestimated its hatred of Russia and communism. The political success of the London program and the economic miracle that was shortly to begin in Western Germany, he concluded in retrospect, stand now in the historical record as authoritative corrections to the extremisms of my outlook in 1949. That miracle, upon which Western Europe's own remarkable recovery was built, may rank as the single most important and consequential economic contribution of the Marshall Plan. As with all legends, the Marshall Plan has its fair share of contrarians. On the question of its economic impact, none is more formidable than the late British economic historian Alan Millward. Wielding vast reams of historical facts and figures, typically buried in dense and difficult prose, Millward weaves an elaborate case against the economic relevance of the Marshall Plan. Far from saving the world, as Kindleberger and others have claimed, Marshall aid was, in Millward's estimation, at best unnecessary. The post-war European world would have looked much the same without it, he declares with bracing dismissiveness. As a trenchant skeptic toward Keynesian analysis that suggested large returns to government-directed investment, Millward is naturally unsurprised by the findings of economist Barry Eichengreen and others that offer little empirical support for its importance. He instead argues that Marshall aid allowed governments to operate with greater inflation and balance of payments deficits than they should have. The debtor-friendly EPU, a poor alternative to general currency convertibility, in his view, reinforced this. Millward is further dismissive of the idea, popularized by historians Michael Hogan and Charles Mayer, that the Marshall Plan operated through the successful export of New Deal political and social constructs. In particular, Europe's adoption of less conflictual American-style labor management relations was held to have fueled productivity growth. This Washington-centric view does indeed seem remote from developments on the ground in Europe, notably in France, where union demands on wages, redistribution, and political representation remain strikingly more hard-edged than in the United States. For its part, the British government consistently pushed back against American efforts to export their industrial management practices. Though there will undoubtedly be trouble if the Americans think that we are not sufficiently interested in productivity, noted one UK Treasury report, their superficial investigations and ill-considered reports need to be resisted. The relations between workers and employers in this country are quite different from that in the United States. In any case, the different uses to which France, Italy, and the UK chose to direct Marshall funds, industrial modernization, inflation control, and debt retirement, respectively, demonstrate that they cannot all have been pursuing an imported American model. Whatever that model was, it was not schizophrenic. Where Millward is on much shakier ground is in arguing that Western Europe's hardships were overstated, and that it could have, and would have, gotten onto the same impressive growth trajectory, albeit a few years later, through a combination of toughing it out and changing to non-dollar-based suppliers. Millward insists that lack of food was not a resource bottleneck. Most Marshall countries, he argued, could have pursued their chosen recovery programs without American aid by maintaining food consumption at 1947 levels. One reason is that they were, he believes, generally consuming much more than government records indicate. Germans, Italians, and Austrians, whose average official rations contained insufficient calories to sustain manual work, had access to a black market that was as important for acquiring food as the legal one. That the 1948 German currency reform instantly filled shop windows was evidence of prior hoarding. Change policy, and the problem goes away. This argument is problematic on at least two grounds. First, U.S. officials were aware of the black markets. Department of Agriculture statisticians, in fact, calculated Germany's food needs under the assumption that the average German had access to 200 calories daily through the black market. An assumption Clay thought reasonable, only for those with exceptional means. Second, the State Department was aware of hoarding and its causes. Clayton constantly drew attention to the problem. But he also believed that aid had to accompany policy reform to support basic levels of consumption during the transition. In Britain, a June 1948 Treasury paper laid out the terrible consequences for food availability if the government were to reject American aid conditions. Millward dismisses it as alarmist and exaggerated. In France, a January 1948 missive to Washington laid out the costs of the latter failing to continue aid. Huge cuts to coal, 25%, oil, 50%, and sugar, 30% allocations, accompanied by soaring unemployment and a possible communist takeover. Millward dismisses it similarly. What else were they likely to say if they wanted the aid? Millward's own calculations, however, show that France, even if it had held food consumption at the depressed levels of the summer of 1947, could not have paid 2 years later for its dollar zone finished goods, steel, vehicle, and industrial raw material imports out of export proceeds. These were possible only because of the Marshall Plan. France's industrial modernization program, Millward himself emphasizes, had widespread national support. Yet it could never have been taken forward without American aid, not even by suppressing food consumption 14% below 1949 levels. So on what can Millward hang his argument that Europe would still have achieved full, but delayed, recovery without the Marshall Plan? First, according to his calculations, some countries, the UK, Italy, West Germany, Belgium, and Luxembourg, could, unlike France, have successfully followed his budgetary reallocation approach, financing their preferred recovery programs without aid at much reduced levels of food consumption. In the case of Italy, at least, however, this conclusion is difficult to accept. The communists were a powerful political force, and public knowledge was near universal that no American aid would be forthcoming if they were present in the government. Fear of losing aid clearly had a depressing impact on the Communist Party's electoral performance, and explains its absence from ruling coalitions after 1947. Without the Marshall Plan, therefore, Italian policy would have been very different. Second, Millward argues that Marshall countries could have shifted their imports to non-dollar sources. But which ones? Incredibly, Millward points to the Federal Republic of Germany, which was only founded in May 1949. Millward specifically highlights the Dutch-German economic symbiosis. The Netherlands, like France, also failed his test of whether its recovery program could have been financed without Marshall aid. Yet Millward insists that the expansion of German trade after 1947 was a powerful force for growth in the Dutch economy, as if this somehow negates his test. There are gaping holes in the argument, however, that German trade could have substituted for Marshall aid. Millward is silent on the mechanism by which a greater symbiosis might have been achieved, and how it would have plugged the Dutch government's financing gap. He argues only, first, that the impact of Marshall aid on growth and German national income is unproven, and therefore unimportant in explaining the growth of Dutch-German trade. And second, that there were forces independent of the Marshall Plan pushing the integration of the Federal Republic into an expanding intra-West European trade circuit. But political forces outside the Marshall Plan were pushing against integration, not for it. France was determined to extract reparations from Germany and to neuter its industrial capacity. It was the United States that made the unilateral decision to reindustrialize Germany, to make French acceptance of this a condition for aid, and to turn the Western-occupied portion of it into an independent state. There is no reason to believe that the United States, had it lacked the motivation to create the Marshall Plan, would still have had the motivation to create West Germany, in defiance of Stalin's threats and pressures. There is, further, no reason to believe that France and Britain would have entered into any system of economic, let alone security integration, within this new entity. The Marshall Plan not only initiated such integration, but held it together. Millward's contrarian take has been rightfully influential in rolling back the deference that many had accorded to early eulogistic accounts of the Marshall Plan. Those accounts reflexively ascribed to it all the economic successes that accompanied and followed it. But Millward's case is ultimately uncompelling, relying as it does on the far-fetched idea that less food and more Germany could have achieved better results. So did the Marshall Plan work? To the extent that it was intended to allow the United States to disengage from Europe militarily, the answer is no. The Truman administration was ultimately obliged to conclude reluctantly